actually is no longer an undergraduate. He's actually an organizer, so that's kind of fun. So what I'd like to do is say a few words quickly in passing, since it was covered so well this morning by Stefano, about modified dispersion relations. I'm actually going to say just a quick little thing about how I came to this work, and in fact, a little bit more about the calculation that led me to this work, in part because it came up in discussions. And then also for the same reason, I'll say a few words about the SR state. Then what I'd like to do is say some words about a first pass through the same sort of calculation using modified dispersion relations in the context of another alternative state system, the way it worked. Then we're going to switch gears entirely. And I'm going to say a few words more about a phenomenological model of discrete spatial geometry. And so this is one of these sort of middle road kind of models, which I hope is going to capture, not maybe even better, you'll be able to correct me and tell me that this has already been done, or we have experimental limits, or something like this. But this is one of these middle road kind of models, which builds between an effective theory and that of what we know in terms of known physics and tests. Finally, I'll say a little something about the Loopy effects in quantum cosmology and perhaps their effects on the primordial gravitational effect. So, similar to the last talk, this is largely work that is not complete, so work. Great. So, a little something about quantum geometry effects. So, this goes back a little ways. Let me describe some work of people present about modified dispersion relations and how they might come about. So if you look at loop quantum gravity and you look at a possible somewhat classical state, this is a tricky thing to do. We don't have a dynamic set. It's hard to just start in that initial calculation and come up with a semi-classical state. This is a rough thing to do. So a reasonable thing to do is to try to come up with something that seems fairly reasonable. So the idea is
to choose a characteristic scale way above the Planck scale, such that you, of course, would expect you get something like the continuum approximation that we know and love and live in. And then for scales much less than that, you're going to see quantum gravity effects. So the idea is to try to look at a state which is peaked on flat geometry and flat connections, and then try to go for computing these expectation values of the matter Hamiltonian. And we'll look at, this was done as essentially a Taylor expansion in LP over L. Okay, again, These results were discussed a little bit this morning, but I just want to say a couple more words about them. So if you look at these two cases, you immediately see all kinds of extra stuff that pops out. And what's interesting about this analysis is that you can't specify particular parameters, how large the effects are, how and precisely how they scale with LP and so forth, but there's clearly new stuff here. There's helicity-dependent correction, there's all kinds of things that we've talked about. And so you're going to see these modified dispersion relations, and of course, as we've seen, there's effects that come out of this, and these effects can be highly, highly constrained. Okay. So, of course, this is a situation where Lorentz invariance is broken, and this is perhaps the key to the strength of these constraints. We have a preferred frame. Let me say a little something about the constants here. So there's an issue about how do you choose this. And so there are a variety of possible ways of doing this, but one choice that was done early on is to choose this, that essentially scales as the momentum. And so that if you look back at here, will then give a particular scaling with the in the dispersion relations. Okay, and so what a variety of us did back many years ago then is to look at these possible constraints, which were then later nicely further constrained by effective theory arguments and further experimental things that we heard about so delightfully this morning. So again, these effects are important in these kinds of scales, and I want to emphasize something else, and that is that this model is certainly not valid because of the nature of the expansion. This model is certainly not valid at momentum scales approaching the Planck scale. It needs to be much less than that. Okay, so just to summarize then, this is a model that was just inspired by looking at a possible heuristic state of Fermi classical gravity and just doing a Taylor expansion in the matter Hamiltonians and seeing what you come up with. And so they suggest that perhaps that we might have different possible corrections to the dispersion relations coming from just the different types of matter around, fermions, leptonic, whatever, hadronic, and so on. So something that's asked, and rightly so, very often in this case, how can you possibly come up with Lorentz violation when you start with a theory that's general relativity, you do a quantization that is Lorentz invariant for the best we know, and so how can you possibly come up with these? Well, from this, it's pretty clear what happens is that there's a dependence on the state, and also, as mentioned a number of times within this this workshop already, the results of Gambini and Pullen, their state was explicitly so. Yes.
To follow from the form of the modified dispersion relations, or do you just assume it?
Right. I won't say that it necessarily follows from this, but with these choices, this is in particular of the parameters that I'm referring to here. This the only way that this can make sense is if in fact this is this momentum is taken in a particular preferred frame, and the natural one is to choose is the one which the CMDR is isotropic. But okay.
Isn't third power a bit odd to discuss parities concerns?
Sure. Yes. And we heard lots of good arguments about that earlier.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yep. And in fact, now there's a lot. I mean, if you go back to the beginning of special relativity, if you were back in 100 plus ish years ago, and you were doing the same kind of work we are now, except for with Lorentz transformations and these kinds of things, well, this would not be particularly natural. You'd be looking at B over C a cube terms when you might be looking at B over C squared, B over C fourth, right? Yeah, so maybe we're just looking at this again.
No, definitely. I should point out that that was an issue 100 years ago. People did start looking up for B over C terms, and it took them a while to realize that classical Maxwell equations imply that possible things can only show up at B over C squared over C squared.
No, the parities, because, we divide this before the Gambini and Pullen. I have to stress it again, not because it's my part, but the difference, which was stressed from Stan. Yeah. The point is the following. The Gambini and Pullen assumed the parity violating case, and it was followed there. I'm not so sure that this state exists in the point, right?
Sure, of course.
I mean, but that's not, I'm not an expert, so. Okay. But that is indeed a parity violating thing. However, if you notice, and it was mentioned in the talk by Vat, by Matt, if this is not, if it is due to some induced metric or some effect of B, then you don't necessarily have a parity violation by just looking at this relation. And therefore, we don't have the birefringence, as Stefano explained this morning. So there are two physically distinct things. Also, I must admit that there is not necessarily a preferred frame, because suppose that you take you have general coordinate invariance if you start from let's say Kostelecki type QED, all right, where one of his eight mu's, suppose that you have a Lorentz violating term, okay, a mu, gamma mu, psi pi, psi, whatever, and then you look at dispersion relations for fermions. If this a mu depends on energy somehow, then the thing is, by definition, coordinate invariant, general coordinate invariant, so frame independent. And Kostelecki was insisting in his parametrization on this. So it could be a preferred frame, which was precisely the cosmological frame used there, but it would not.
So what I'm trying to do is set this in a particular context, right? So I agree, if you look at something like the extended model and so forth, that's a different
I'm sorry, I think I have to disagree with you.
Okay.
Because in Kostelecki's scheme, it's true that the thing is fully coordinate invariant, but there is a particular frame in which, for example, the A mu will take a particular simple form. And this would be, for example, if it's a finite vector, there was one frame in which it has
each point in
is a pair. Okay, then there is a preferred frame. However,
in the accident, it means that we can't take spontaneous breaking or intrinsic
that's
breaking.
Right.
Okay. This does not have to be intrinsic breaking of Lorentz invariant.
That's
could be
that's my
spontaneous
point.
Breaking of Lorentz invariant,
right.
But I think there is a different breaking of Lorentz invariant.
Right.
Okay. Let's stop there.
This sort of discussion, I think, is what this workshop is all about. So I think it's a great thing.
Well, we can add it at the end of the
okay. So So again, just to remind you a little bit about these threshold calculations, because I'm going to be using the same context in a moment. The idea is to, for starters, take this kappa. Again, the Planck scale would normalize that to be something like unity. And so, again, these are highly constrained now. It looks like the model is dead, right? So, but I'd like to look at this in the case of white dwarfs to see what we can see. So, what we're going to be looking at, again, is a case where we have a momentum, which is much, much higher than the mass scale, but for the particle mass, like the fermion, is far less than the scale of the Planck scale. Okay, so a comment, just simply because it came up a couple times in the last couple days about TSR and the threshold. So what you can do is just apply the same analysis, that is to say, what happens to particle process thresholds in the context of TSR. So in the usual context of what Stefano was referring to this morning, we assume, of course, that energy momentum is conserved as usual in the familiar way. In the TSR, that's definitely not the case. What's particularly handy is the Jude-Visser variables allow you to sort of simply express the modified energy momentum laws. And so then you can do the same analysis. Right? So initially, it came to this thinking that it would be fairly easy to get some strong constraints on these modifications coming from this. But here's a distinct case. In a deformed symmetry case, it's not simple. The breaking of Lorentz invariance in the previous case of the threshold analysis was a key to give such powerful constraints. In this case, it's not so easy. So just to give a flavor of how this works, if you just take a look at a simple two-particle process with a bunch of outgoing particles, then in special relativity, you can the center mass frame, you can simply express the threshold energy. I'm going to make one assumption here, which is critical here, especially for these couple slides. And that is that in terms of composite particles, we're not assuming that there are any large changes to the basic TSR setups. This is a very specific assumption, so we're not sort of rescaling by this gamma that came up in Lorentz contest and so forth. So what we're going to do is just sort of look at, if you will, fundamental particles, and then actually I'm going to say something about GTK, so I have to say something about composites.
So the energy that is conserved and the energy momentum that is conserved here is the one that they call the physical one.
The physical energy momentum have modified energy concentration.
And that's the one that is conserved.
I think that what you're doing is that you're composing linearly the this value.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then from there you have seen the composition of the physical energy momentum.
The physical energy momentum does not satisfy the usual familiar form.
Conservation form.
Right. It's modified.
Right. It's the one that is inherited from the conservation laws of the unphysical ones.
Of the
From the point of view of the calculation, it just provides a useful method of computing what are the energy momentum conservation.
I don't want to abuse that method, but I have a question at this point. In this kind of methodology, what worries me is that so you can do the kinematics, but what about the reaction phase? How do you know that in VSR framework we don't have yet the theory?
I agree. You'd have to go to the dynamics, but I think at this first pass, you see some results which will lead you to, like some of us, to realize it's probably not worth going to that level. I'll hopefully explain that. So we have modified dispersion relations, and we have modified energy momentum conservation. So what happens is that in this context, get modifications, but they are not big. Okay, this is the big thing. So here's an example for Michaelis-Collins, the double special relativity. Big long expression, but the key thing to look at is two things. The lambda here is the scale of the theory. Think about Planck scale, and the one over the Planck energy would be lambda, right? And so this is a very tiny correction on top of the usual special relativity result, and furthermore, we'll just lower thresholds. Okay, we don't see any new process processes whatsoever.
Okay.
So there's not all these sort of very powerful tools that are observed that we can use in the Lorentz operating case. Okay. So just for fun and for tomorrow's talk, what I'd like to do is just sort of flash the GCK process. Keep in mind, right, we have a problem here, and we're applying this to protons, and so it's possible, but keep that in mind. So again, you can do the calculation in the usual case. You get something like this. That's special relativity. The modifications, you can actually just work out exactly, but probably easier to digest is our are the just comparison to the DSR we have just discussed. Okay, and so again, the special relativity result is shifted just slightly downwards. Okay, and so similarly for the other Giovanni's DSR, similar kind of expression. So the threshold again is shifted down slightly, and these are spikes. Okay. And so they're so slight, in fact, that I don't think it's worth it. You're not going to see large effects coming from this, or the ability to constrain this precisely.
What about you not have the anomalous reaction, like Cherenkov?
Exactly. Right. No back in Cherenkov, right. And no decaying photons, all that stuff is gone. So that's why
you're not going to see a lot of these high precision tests.
Formulation to tell me what is the dispersion relation of a proton in DSR.
Exactly.
Quarks and the gluons, C,
exactly.
And all these things. We don't know.
Okay. So I just want to mention that because it came up in the air a couple times. So there is a sort of simplistic first pass on the threshold analysis of DSR.
You don't see any large effects. And furthermore, you just shift the special relativity threshold slightly and down. Okay. That's the bottom. Okay. So another example I'd like to just mention is one about the Chandrasekhar mass. I was giving a talk about various kinds of things some time ago to some astronomers, and they said, well, you should try it here, right? Because it's very obvious. This is an ultra-relativistic system. What's the idea? The idea is that, oh, by the way, this is a Sirius A and B. This is the thing you see in the sky. This is the thing you don't. This is the white dwarf companion, which is, that's an optical image. It's quite nice. But so it does actually, you know, glow. But it's very, very dim. So a white dwarf is a highly compact star. Its compositions can be largely helium and carbon. There's various different compositions. And the idea, basically, though, is that what you've got is something that is contracted by gravity, and then there's a very, very high level of electron degeneracy pressure that prevents it from contracting further. So there's sort of a balance between electron degeneracy pressure and the gravitational attraction. And so the, just one second. And so back in what, 31, something like this. So Chandrasekhar did the first calculation of finding the maximum mass that you might expect from a white dwarf where you have a balance of these two. Yes?
Well, there's something I simply don't understand. General relativity is born from special relativistic considerations. What into special relativity with gravity? Once you change special relativity into something complicated, you need to change gravity. You cannot keep the same theory of gravity. So in order to really attack this question, I don't think you are equipped.
Yeah, so an excellent point. So what's interesting about this calculation, though, is that it doesn't require general relativity. Well, I'll get to that. But roughly speaking, it doesn't require general relativity. In particular, you don't need general relativity to get this. Okay? What you need, what was used, is just Newtonian gravity. So the corrections you'd expect to GR from these kinds of symmetries, just like, well, these kind of deformations, these kinds of symmetries that you just discussed, would presumably occur at lower order to even GR. And then, but the more important effect is simply just the Newtonian gravity. Okay? An excellent point, but
I think of the natural expectation is that the corrections would occur at lower order. Okay? Or sorry, higher order.
Yes. No, okay, so, okay. So let me use this moment to say, so I discussed DSR for just a moment. I'm back to the Lorentz breaking case, and the same case that we looked at threshold.
Oh, sorry, the previous thing was from Lorentz violating case.
Okay, so
the previous.
Yeah, sorry. So what we're doing is, so I said a little about the threshold case where we have Lorentz breaking. Then I said, well, what about DSR? In DSR, we have modified energy momentum, and so it's, it forms the tree, not break. Okay? That was just a little interlude to say something about ESR. Now we're back to the case where we actually have break,
including the previous transpires.
Previous transparency is 1983 Nobel Prize work. So, no. No break the lights of the tree.
You mean I'm in space, you can never get another prize?
Is there some reason why you're looking at white dwarfs, not neutron stars?
Yes. Sure. Because
the energy scale is a mega, an MeV versus a GeV, where equation of state.
In fact, the calculation is the same.
Yeah, I know, yeah. But
yes, so
the effect must be stronger for neutron stars.
Right. Oh, so let me make a comment about that after I get to the end of this. Otherwise, I spill all the beans now. No surprise. Okay. So now we have this relation, same thing I said before. We have breaking of Lorentz invariants. This analysis can only work in this regime here. Well, excuse me, it can work when the momentum is less than the mass, but it's not really relevant, right? We're looking at ultra-relatives in case, but the key thing is we do have an upper level that we'll talk about. So here's the calculation. It differs only slightly from the usual one, but I wasn't familiar with the usual one, so let me say a few words anyway, not a lot, but a few words about the calculation. So the idea is that you have an isotropic degenerate electron gas. Okay, and so what you can do is just compute using good old StatNet techniques the pressure. Okay, so what we've done here is look at what you'd expect for the pressure given the modifications that you would have in the energy. So if you glance down here, the stuff in red is just the modification. So in the normal calculation, you simply get rid of the things with red and you just have the usual result. And the delta here is just given by the mass electron over the Planck scale, so it's pretty nice small. And so this is a tiny little correction on top of the usual result. However, by the way, x is just rescaled momentum with respect to the electron mass. And this clearly is something that's going to get, the idea is we're going to scale this up and to see what happens. And so the usual calculation where you get the 1.44 solar masses is essentially you're pushing the relativistic scale up to as far as you can, infinity. Okay? Some tables listing this at infinity. So very, very ultra-relativistic system. Let me also say that because this pressure dominates in the system, this is essentially a completely degenerate good old D equals zero electron gas, so it's very easy to do the combination. This is just a volume angle, right? No more than that. And then there's no weighting having to do with N here for T equals zero, this is just volume. So that's the source of the pressure in the star, right? It's not the source of the mass so much, it's just the source of the pressure. So the pressure in the star is given by this expression, right? The mass is clearly because of your protons and things like that, a bit of the bound mass. And so that's the important thing, the density. And so, I'll say a little word about Schwarzschild. We don't need to get. Okay. So the density simply scales as momentum cube. That's the critical thing. The other little critical thing of this is that this number, which is just the free factor that goes along with these white dwarfs, is large. That's all. Something 10^6. That's just all we needed, this funny master units. Okay, so
equilibrium occurs when this degeneracy pressure, the gradient in the degeneracy pressure balances gravitational attraction. So this is the form of gravity I'm using. Good old Newton, okay? Sorry, with apologies to everybody in the audience. So this is what I'm using, and the key thing that we need to do is figure out the density, how the mass scales the radius, and just go for it, okay? So a few manipulations you get here, okay? There's no modifications here. This is a standard thing. That what's hidden here, of course, is the modifications that we saw in P. But in fact, interestingly, they're not so important there. But in density, okay. So it's convenient to re-express that ODE in another form. So Q is just this normalized thing. What is it normalized? It's normalized to one at the center of the star. So it's the normalized energy ZC, as I've called it. It's the energy of the star compared to the electron mass, and then just Q is the scaling with that as you go out in R, in the radius. There's also rescaling in the radius, that's what this is, but it's not so important. So where does the modification occur? Well, it's here. Normally, this would be something like Q minus 1 over Z sorry, q squared minus 1 over z squared, all q, to the 3 halves. And so the modification is just a slight modification on top of that. Okay, in this range where we're looking at high momentum, so significantly above the electron mass scale, but significantly below the flux scale. Okay, so that's what we get. Here we go. Okay. So let me just show you some results. So the red and blue lines are the standard case, and that's blue, standard case, and then the result that I've been showing in red here with the little red fractions. It's tiny. It's a small effect. Okay. So again, Q is normalized so that the, I'll explain what parameters we use in this in a moment, but Q is normalized so that the energy is just one at the center of the star. We're looking at radius versus Q, okay, essentially versus energy, okay? And when this crosses down here, this is the end, right? This is so the energy goes to zero. That means that we've hit the boundary, so we're out on the outer radius of the star. Okay.
So
what do you get in a little more detail? So what I've done here is just chosen the largest energy that I could have any guts for in terms of this computation. That is to say, I want to make sure that the momentum was well below the Planck scale. And so that's what this is. And so you get, you know, the order, you know, 10% kind of variation in the actual computation of the Chandrasekhar mass. Okay? And these are for, let me emphasize, these are for the electron parameters in the dispersion relation that are order one. And so we know this morning that they're a lot less, a whole lot less, right? You wouldn't see the effect at all. Okay. In that context.
It's very surprising because the scale at which the equation of state becomes relativistic is going to be mean.
Yeah.
And you have tiny effects. That's, why is it?
Right.
Tiny,
right.
Well, why is it such a big effect?
Yeah.
Because you're sitting right on the instability. So.
Not so much. Now, it really comes. It's sort of a funny feature of the actual Chandrasekhar calculation, and that is that the mass limit comes from infinite momentum. That's where the mass limit comes from. So the 1.44 is you just crank the momentum up as high as you can. And so that's what I've done here, right? I've cranked up the energy of the electrons at the center of the star to be 10 to the 21. I mean, it's huge, right? This is 10 to the 21 times the mass of the electron. And so, again, it's the mass limit. Astrophysically, this is a totally another game, which I'll talk about in a moment, but the actual number comes from the infinite momentum. And that's why it is.
But I have an objection.
Please.
When we ecliptic, or when we speak of equilibrium in this way, we assume that the pressure represents the momentum that the lower amount of gas is going to put on the upper bunch of gas. But when they
Just understand lower and upper, you mean
radius. I have a star and there is this piece of gas that is being attracted to the center of the star and is being supported by the pressure.
But, yes.
Right. So the amount of gas that is underneath is pushing on the upper.
Yes.
But that is because the momentum of the material below is transferred to the momentum of the material above, normally, in the normal momentum conservation. But when we have new type of momentum conservation equation,
oh, it's normal momentum conservation. Normal momentum. Sorry. Just modify the dispersion relation.
I'm sorry. Okay. Excuse me.
And how far is this effect actually from the sense of the MBR? How can you reliably say that if you say transform the infinite momentum region and infinite momentum, all kinds of things.
No, sorry. It can't come from infinite momentum. So I've only run the, okay. So if I go back to here, and really to do infinite momentum, the curves would be wildly divergent. You wouldn't even see the red curve. It would be dropping so fast, okay? And so the Chandrasekhar mass would be completely different, okay? What I'm doing is a calculation in the regime I'm allowed to compute, okay? The momentum cannot get up to the Planck scale, or my dispersion relation is wrong. Right, this whole expansion thing doesn't work, and it's, you know, I'm out of my league in terms of the Taylor
expansion. Effectively, you're not letting the central pressure go to infinity.
Right.
You're letting it be as high as it possibly can, but you can still trust the dispersion relation.
Absolutely. That's what I'm doing. And in the Chandrasekhar calculation, you are going to infinite limit. Right, so I'm going to a finite.
Because it's like the case in which you're going to have mass
infinity. Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So So how high up in energy do you go
then? 10 to the 21 masses of mass of the light.
Naively, it's a big assumption to assume the validity of a flat space-time-based approximation to general relativity.
Fair, but there's less, I can say a few words about that. I will in a moment. Let me just say, I guess I didn't write down here, but you can compute the radii for these stars, right?
And this one, with the positive parameters pulled in, it's more dense. General relativistic correction should be a greater effect. And then this one, of course, is a larger one. So this has a larger radius. I guess I just said it here for this, but that's a larger radius. Okay. Good. Super. Okay. So there's lots of buts. Okay. First of all, this disagrees with what's in the literature. Okay. So Camacho has actually computed in context of this, there's many levels to do this Chandrasekhar calculation. One is a calculation that you might do using a sort of a first pass using some stat mech, which I sort of started, but then sort of got to a. Let me explain. This is a little more involved calculation involving this sort of modified equation here. Okay, but you can do a little rougher calculation, and that's the context. So he did a bunch of work looking at various kinds of distribution functions in terms of stat mech, density functions, and so forth. And so what he looked at using that sort of first pass was that he saw that it was possible to discard positive values of this parameter that I'm calling the zeta here. So this this we don't see. Okay, so.
And so for sort of reasons you'd expect it to be as we sort of over and over to be negative. But what we see is that, well, it modifies it, right? It just gets a lot more mass. Okay. The other thing is that the corrections, I get what I would need to do is trace through that method of the computation
and just sort of compare them before I can comment too much further. But I just want to let you know that at the moment, literature disagrees with this technique. These corrections are small, sort of 10%, so maybe other people have different ideas about this. I was sort of expecting sort of order one kinds of corrections, naively. Furthermore, as we've heard this morning so nicely, the parameters are already constrained much further than we can provide using any kind of mass limits from observations to these. But the biggest but is that even in the normal case, the mass limit is relatively a theoretical construction of only theoretical interest. What happens in actual astrophysics is a whole bunch of other effects, neutronization, through inverse beta decay, occur at much, much lower densities. And then GR corrections, interestingly enough, for stability, so I just did equilibrium. For a stability analysis, you have to go to GR, okay? And so then you use the Schwarzschild solution and so forth. These kinds of processes occur at much, much lower densities. The densities, roughly scale, this is why I wanted you to remember this, is that roughly 10 to the 6 times this sort of a normalized energy. And so we're talking about densities that are far, far above known, well-known, actually, processes, which then will cause the white dwarf to turn into a neutron star or other things like that. Yes, did you have a question?
Yes, sir.
All right, so the only hope that
anything like this could be seen or that there'd be sort of constraints and so forth would be some sort of secondary effects. The only things that I can think of are sort of such a large accretion onto a white dwarf or a neutron star for that matter, and then some type of supernova. So there's this sort of interesting Champagne supernova where it looks like the Chandrasekhar mass was exceeded by maybe one solar mass briefly. So I think what you have to do is look a lot further into this. Another comment that I'd like to make is that in the case of neutron stars, there are known physical processes that cause the collapse of force field of black hole and so forth. But there, the physics is just the particle physics is not known as well as this context. Okay, and so there, that even sort of standard physics is just not so known so well. So if we're looking for constraints, and especially these densities, we don't have them. Okay.
Right.
So to switch gears. Okay, so the first topic was a little bit about threshold analysis and DSR, right? The second was a Chandrasekhar mass. And then what I'd like to do is say a few words about a completely different model, one in which we sort of try to build a phenomenological test theory. Okay? So
what I'd like to do is just remind you of something which I find quite interesting, perhaps even delightful, is a result of Ted Jacobson's from some years ago, which says that you can derive Einstein's equation from the first law. And I just have a quote here from, if you want to read a little bit more detail, as you're perhaps already doing. But the basic idea, again, is that if general relativity can be derived from a first law of thermodynamics, then it sure looks like general relativity at least has the flavor, or perhaps is, a macroscopic theory. So that suggests perhaps, is that deep geometry, the deep geometry of space or space-time, would have no metric structure. Okay, and so we are thinking about this. What I'm doing is thinking about this metric as simply a thermodynamic macroscopic variable. And so the idea is somewhat crazy, but here it goes. If the deep geometry is not metric-based, then all this stuff that we've been talking about it doesn't make any sense. Okay, and in fact, the only way we could have the world as we know it, that familiar quantities such as gravitational and inertial mass, metric, so on and so forth, have to emerge out of something else. This have to emerge out of deep geometry. So that means on this scale, the equivalence principle is violated. All these cherished things are violated. Okay, and so clearly we're in a different environment, and also clearly we have some possibility of measuring these effects because, as we've seen, breaking local Lorentz invariance is a major thing, and it leads to remarkable consequences that we can perhaps use to constrain possible models quite well. Yes?
What do you mean that these symmetries are broken if they don't? How can you talk about an asymmetry at all?
Fair. But if I were to use the continuum approximation all the way down to the deep geometry scale, then it would look like the Lorentz invariance and all these symmetries are broken.
But that might be only the fact that the space-time there is discrete, and yes, you cannot use the continuous approximation.
That's right.
I can see that some white broken. I mean, even if there is an underlying thing, maybe perhaps it doesn't select for your preferred frame.
I reserve this at the end, because a spontaneous equivalence does not select the preferred frame, but not space-time. It's like an electric field. If you have an electric field in dimension, I mean, the Lagrangian thing that the before the verb is general form.
You're saying if there is an emergent space time, somehow you would expect that you can have this kind of violation. Although it's not obvious that any emergent feature should have all these violations.
Absolutely. I'm just pointing out essentially an obvious fact. If you don't have a metric around, then how do you talk about Lorentz invariance and all these things on that scale? And in some cases, you really can, but not all cases. And what I'd like to do is sort of develop some thinking about spatial geometry, so just deep, discrete spatial geometry. So there you might expect some other crazy stuff. Okay, now to state the obvious, of course, this is crazy, right? Because of the observed geometry state. We don't know, spontaneously inflating extra dimensions.
We're not looking at signature change all the time. No change in the orientation of space. Furthermore, there's a really cold place with a Planck temperature that range. And so it's clearly we have a situation that is quite stable, which then suggests that if you want to get some of these effects, then what you perhaps can do is use the effective field theory framework. Okay, so here's an idea, right? So you're going to have scalars, so masses. You're going to have a metric emerge from some deeper geometry. Then the question is also, well, why haven't you seen a vector? Okay. And so what I'm going to do is propose a model here, which there is a vector, and it's going to be a local preferred direction. But of course, we haven't seen such a thing. It's highly constrained. So I'm going to look at it in the following way, and that is that there's some dynamics coming from the underlying geometry. I mean, if you just think about something like an electron traveling through, I mean, if it is able to access small scales, so some fundamental particle, if you think about it traveling through some discrete geometry, then it's going to have to have, it cannot follow what's continuous, normal, familiar trajectory simply because the underlying geometry can't support it. Okay, this is the basic idea. Okay. So the idea is to come up with a test theory to sort of try to constrain these possible effects. So the idea is that this will be this preferred direction is going to have some stochastic dynamics, and it can depend on things like the energy of the particle and those sorts of things. Okay, so, which I'm not specifying at the moment, but would hope to do so in the future. So the average, so if you were to look at any length of time or any region of space and these kinds of things, and the average is going to vanish. But what about the variance? What about the, can we see any effects that?
Yes, the effects due to mu.
So let me say this is the idea is that there's a very local preferred direction. It varies. And then this is a spatial direction field. There's some very nice work by Jacobson and Mattingly and now others on a time-like field that's part of the theory. Okay, so because the continuum approximation is so good of the deep geometry, then we can use the ideas, we can use effective field theory and look at the possible constraints on parameters of the theory and explore tests and all those good things. Okay, so here's Lemaître mentioned this earlier. This, you can look at an effective field theory for fermions, and what I'm going to do, again, the idea is that the sort of residual effect of the deep geometry is simply going to be modeled in this particular example with a simple fluctuating preferred direction. Okay, that's the idea. So if you just look at the relativistic Lagrangian for good old spin 1/2 fermions, you have something like this. You can write it out. This is often what's done in the it's quite similar to the extended standard model of Kostolecki. I'll make a comment about that. But the origin is completely different. The dynamics is completely different. And so there's little differences there. OK, so you have a master and this modified with the direction field. I just wrote down all the forms of these corrections. And so the idea then is to, one idea is to look at possible corrections that you can do in the lab. So you could look at low energy, high precision tests of local Lorentz invariants and so forth. And so what you can do is just an expansion in P over M and just see what you get. Okay, so doing that transformation, then you get something that looks like this. So you get M, right? You get P squared over 2M. That's good. That's all the usual stuff. But then you get a lot of other stuff. This is anisotropic mass. This is spin-coupled anisotropic mass. And all kinds of other little terms like this, which already are highly constrained for fixed vector fields. So perhaps like in the Kostolecki model, right? But in this case, these guys are fluctuating. Okay? So let me just highlight those correction terms. And so those are the ones that are come about in these kinds of models. Okay? So I won't dwell on this very long. But I wanted to point out that you can, of course, just re-express those in terms of the preferred direction, of course. So the anisotropic mass is given just by a pair of those direction fields and so on. So that's the sort of idea is to produce one of these phenomenological test theories, the sort of in between that involves a stochastic spatial direction field. So there's lots of tests that you can imagine applying to these, applying on this theory. For larger things like spin, torsion, pendulum, of course, you're averaging over a huge spatial region, and so you're not getting at the dynamics of the field, and that you're looking at sort of Hughes-Drever kinds of effects for preferred vector fields through that exist in space. So that's a little bit different. Let me just make a little comment. So the extended standard model of Kostolecki and collaborators has some of the same parameters, but those parameters come about through spontaneous symmetry breaking, like this come up over and over. These are not things that are fluctuating due to the sort of deep geometry of space. And so this is dynamical. And then it's also not the same as a nonmetric test theory is, again, because of the dynamical quantity. And so then there may be a relation to the metric fluctuations of Ford. But here, of course, I'm looking at a vector field, not a metric one.
Limit is where the ordinary metric is much smaller than your new contribution. So that's what you say. So you are not in the fourth regime. It's as if you have a metric near an horizon or a metric where the effect of the metric vanishes. So you don't have a space time, but you have your new.
Yeah, yeah. That's great. Yeah. Okay, so last topic that I'd like to
like to say a few words about is just another possible model. And this one it comes from a sort of a thinking about the early universe. Okay, so let me say a little something about possible loopy effects in the gravitational wave background now. So what's very nice is Ricard said a few words a moments ago about possible corrections you'd expect in sort of a loopy type quantization. Okay, so here the corrections are the same. Okay, so this is the same idea. And so in these remarks, I'm just going to focus sort of on the method. I can say one word about the results so far, but the two preliminaries to quote performance sense. So the corrections that come from the loopy effective theory are in some sense kinematical in the context that these operators, the 1 over a kind of operators, just are ill-defined. You have to redefine them. And then you can define, you can write them out in all possible ways. And so we've done some of that work, and so you can look at the quantization ambiguities. And if you do that, then so far of all the models that we've studied, so we've looked at some new quantum cosmology models of Mark Bowell, and then also the Hussein-Binkler model that Ricard, of course, just was mentioning some aspects of a moment ago. And so in leading order, so the sort of the effects that you might expect, then what we get are, depending on the particular model, the quantization ambiguities, you get a different parameters here for epsilon, but they are definitely small numerical parameters. And then depending on the model, you get different powers of the correction. Small corrections. What I've done here with this A star, this is the scaled universe at the surface of semi-classicality, as was discussed earlier.
That is to say, at the point which you can start using effective equations for the evolution of both the metric and the tensor mode, or the fluctuations in the metric. And before that, we really don't have the confidence that we'd like to actually sort of do a calculation from the sort of beginning. But what's interesting is that these effective equations are valid very, very early in the universe. Okay. The other thing is, and I'm not going to say a lot about that today, but the background dynamics, the actual dynamics of A, the Friedmann, Robertson, Walker equations in these contexts, are modified themselves. Okay. So let me say a few words about what we see and sort of what the setup this is. Okay, so the idea is that we just start with the action. Okay, we just start with the action, but we say, well, this the normal action of GR. But the idea is that we're going to think about this as an expectation value in the background state. And so what we're going to do is split the normal metric into in terms of a sort of Friedmann, Robertson, Walker like piece, and then the tensor fluctuations, the perturbations on top of that. So the absolutely the usual context, the only difference is that we're looking at a expectation value, and that expectation value gives us sort of a measure of the possible kinematical effects of this discrete space. So this is the same, again, the same corrections that Ricard looked at, this 1 over R type corrections. Okay. So in this case, the 1 over scale factor. And so, just in raw form, you get something like this. So this is for the, of course, Fourier modes for the gravitational waves, and you get a modified evolution that looks something like this, which you can do with some change of variables and some fancy stuff, and you get this expression. So the usual form is the beginning, and then you get some modifications here. All right. So so far, what we'd like to do, so far what we've done is looked at this in a sort of simple two-stage cosmological model where we have some inflation and a radiation-dominated era, and then looked at the gravitational wave spectrum on the other end. And so looking at...
The way you did the splitting, or it's a generic splitting?
This one is
small. It's small. Yeah. You assume, sorry, it's
small fluctuations. Yes, small. Yes, to make the calculation go through. And so at that level, there's absolutely no effect as compared with the standard picture. But there's other things we want to look at, including the changes in actual background evolution of A. And furthermore, I've been learning more, it's going to be critical to look at the initial state on this. What we've been just doing is the Bunch-Davies vacuum, but there's clearly we have to do some more careful thinking about that, perhaps even thinking about mode creation. A star is the size of the universe at the point where we say we can use effective equations.
Dependent statement, or is there some? Can you choose some other gauge for H and get a different equation?
I don't know the answer to that, with the exception that this is the same scenario as unusual case. Okay, So,
which of course is always very gauged.
So, what initially going to this, all I wanted to do was the following. People were saying, well, we're looking at LISA, we're looking at maybe looking at this who's got gravitational wave background. What can you tell us about looping stuff? And so the idea was, well, I don't know, let's compare that to the usual, exactly the normal calculation, just looking at these early universe effects through effective equations. Based on that, can I say anything about those possible observed possibilities? That was the initial part of your question. At the moment, in terms of the actual physics and the what you're actually seeing in terms of the stochastic background, I don't have a good handle on that one. But I'd love to learn more. Okay, I think that's all I want to say. So just by way of summary, I just looked at, reminded you about some threshold analysis when Lorentz invariance is broken. I guess
the overall lesson in one line for this is that when you have that kind of effect, so when you have modified dispersion relations, for instance, and breaking Lorentz invariance, you can do great things. You can do fantastic, powerful constraints, as we've heard about earlier today. Not so in deformed symmetries, in the case of deformed symmetries. Okay, there's some changes, but they're mild, okay? And perhaps not either astrophysically or in the laboratory. They're perhaps just not accessible. In a similar case, even in the ultra-relativist case of the sort of theoretical Chandrasekhar mass, you're looking at the corrections of only 10%. And so it's looking like the astrophysical, unless you can see something more subtle, sort of a secondary thing, it looks like it's not particularly relevant in terms of what you see for masses of white dwarfs and so forth. I mentioned a possible phenomenological test model, which involves a fluctuating stochastic local direction field, and just a flash to formulation in terms of low energy physics for equivalence principle tests. And then I also just mentioned a few thoughts about loopy effects in the primordial tensor wave background. Great, thank you.
Could you just tell me a little bit more about the motivation for the number three? I mean, it's because it's, I couldn't see how it jived with, say, just discrete models we know about in matter discreteness. For instance, to consider a gas or a glass, now those things have rotational invariance, translation invariance, and the effective models all the way down in some ways, until the continuum effective description breaks down completely. So there's no, I mean, in the effective model, the rotational invariance is there until the only place where it would break down is when you actually see the atom. So how is that consistent with what?
Well, I guess. Sure. I guess it's a question of a bit of scale. And so if indeed the D geometry is discrete, right, of space or space-time, then the question is really at what point are you going to expect kinds of effects? And so the natural naive scale, of course, the Planck scale. But there's a huge room. Right? I mean, the Planck scale is just so far away from known physics that it may not fit. We've seen proposals in this conference, of course, for this scale is significantly below the Planck scale we're relevant. That's one piece of it. Another piece of it is some years ago I was looking at an angle operator in Planck gravity. And so in that context, that has a discrete spectrum and so forth, but there's no natural scale for it, just three-dimensional analysis, so there's no natural scale. So the state itself has to give the scale of these effects, and so I thought, well, there is no scale in that context, so it makes sense to look for some scale through those sort of practice theory.
Coming back to the your new field, your oscillating mechanism, yeah. You don't impose any constraint on it, such as to be a velocity, so as you know, and flat, you know.
I mean, I say it's spatial.
That's what I mean.
Yes,
because
sorry.
It could be, that's right, yeah. You do, in a sense, so you zero is zero. But it could be another constraint, the one we have, because in the repatriate case, you have a recoil field.
Yes.
And that gives you, okay, you don't have, I mean, you use it when you don't have a normal space, but we have corrections, and that is u mu, but then the constraint u mu is minus one, because of the, it's a for velocity. So u0 is always This is similar also correction to what Bechenstein tries to get the tests here, when he tries to get the modified Newtonian dynamics. Mm-hmm. It has a correction A mu, it has a field A mu, which corrects the metric A mu, A mu. And I come back, I take 20 seconds to my point, which is crucial of not having a preferred frame in these theories, only the solution select the frame. And I will tell you why I'm saying this. Suppose that your A mu was P mu proportional to the metric, right? Which is so if the verb is proportional to the momentum of the particle, which could be, then of course P mu x mu, you can change your frame by changing x mu, but the theory, P mu will also change because it's a covariant vector, the other is covariant, and that's why it's a frame independent. That's what Ossolesi always insisting, that he's under before the verb. And this is important for the following reason. I will tell you why for just one moment. That's what I mean. It's practically important. If you break the frame independence from the beginning, which of course is possible, if you assume that the modified special relation is fundamental, and your Lagrangian has a frame dependence, then you can understand how complicated it is to compute cross sections. You would not even have the right to go to the center of mass frame. You wouldn't be able of doing lamp shift. You wouldn't be able of doing anything. I mean, you have to get stuck with your cosmological frame, and then you have to take into account all the relative velocities with respect to that frame. If you start conceptually from the Kostelesky thing that you assume you have vector fields, but then eventually they get a verb and the solution selects a direction, then you are allowed in these theories to do all these things because they are frame independent, and then at the end the solution breaks. It's like cosmology.
No, but the point of the way I refer to frame independence or preferred frame is the question of whether in the lab, and yes, outside of your control,
you don't disagree with
and that. Outside of your control, you could measure in principle, your velocity with respect to some absolute velocity. Your velocity with respect to the frame in which this vector that permeates which may arise from some spontaneous symmetric breaking, sure, may arise from some vector, but it's not under your control. You cannot turn it off. So in your lab, you measure that you're moving with respect.
It depends. You can turn it off. It depends on the origin. That's what I'm saying.
No. If it's an electric field, I know I can turn it off.
But if it is also a recoil of the thing, if the defined dispersion relation comes from an induced metric, like what Matt was discussing, but then you can go to the framework.
Remember, there was all discussion way back in the 20s, Einstein going on about general covariance, how it was important to write covariant theory. And eventually, anything can be made covariant by putting on enough extra non-geometrical fields.
Sure.
And the same sort of game can be applied here. Even if there is a violent, explicit breaking of Lorentz invariance, I can always write it in a way to make it look like a Lorentz invariant theory with then an additional four vector thrown in that does the breaking for me. And if I then look at it that way, I can always play games.
Yeah, but my point was,
and so on, and it might let me calculate.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. My point is, when you speak about a preferred frame, I never liked it, because also when you have an electric field, Jack Hill also doesn't like the term. Because, string theory, as you probably know, doesn't pick up any preferred frame, but you have backgrounds which have preferred directions of fluxes and weather. So that was my original point. It's practical, because otherwise you would not be able to calculate in cross-sections.
Okay, we have a speaker here.
Well, I did ask.
Any other question?
Some comment, since you mentioned type 1a supernovae, these usually explode long before they reach criticality for Chandrasekhar mass collapse. So I doubt that you will get any useful constraints from 1a. Maybe you have a better idea.
Clearly the neutralization occurs at much lower density.
Well, it has nothing to do with neutralization. This is simply because
they
burn. They're really, really hot in the center.
Other questions? Okay, then let's have the speaker again.